Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, and I'm broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. Our listeners who are interested in the issue of ID in physics and cosmology are absolutely going to love our podcast today, because we have with us a special guest, Dr. Bruce Gordon, who is Discovery Institute's research director, who also holds a background in the issue of physics and cosmology. So, Dr. Gordon, thank you very much for being with us on the show today.
I'm pleased to be here, Casey. Thank you for having me.
So you're the research director of Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, is that right?
That is correct.
Well, you know, I'd love to talk to you more about what kind of research Discovery Institute is doing and funding, and I know that you're very closely involved with that, but I think we're going to have to hold that off for a subsequent podcast. How does that sound?
That sounds just fine to me.
So first off, can you tell us a little bit about your academic background and what your PhD is in?
Well, my academic background actually is a bit of a hodgepodge. Most irrelevant for the present purposes is probably my degree in piano performance. But more relevant would be my Bachelor of Science in Applied Mathematics and Master's degrees in Analytic Philosophy and Systematic Theology. And then, of course, my PhD in the History and Philosophy of Science from Northwestern, more particularly focused on the foundations of modern physics. So quantum mechanics, relativity, statistical mechanics, string theory, stuff like that.
Well, Bruce, I happen to have a piano right here, actually, in the conference room. So if you'd like
to show
off some of your skills here, we wouldn't mind. But Bruce, I know that you are a very interesting guy, has a very interesting educational background. What exactly does it mean to do a PhD in the history and philosophy of science with a focus on the foundations of modern physics?
Well, I focused actually on the implications for the metaphysics of possibility and necessity in relation to what we know from quantum statistical mechanics.
Thank you for clarifying.
Well, you asked. I thought I would tell you what my dissertation dealt with, but I rarely get asked that anymore.
Well,
thank goodness.
Yeah, last time I asked you that question. What I really wanted to talk to you today about are the arguments for cosmic design through cosmic fine-tuning. So what are the arguments for cosmic fine-tuning, and in your view, do they represent arguments for cosmic design?
That is a very complicated question. So let me give you a short summary by saying that I think there is very compelling evidence that the laws and constants of physics in our universe are fine-tuned for life, and that this in turn provides strong evidence for cosmic design. Perhaps it's best if I give you some examples. So let me give you three examples and then talk about how some cosmologists are trying to resolve the difficulty by appealing to the string multiverse and why this strategy is both implausible and problematic in itself. So first of all, first example to consider would be the gravitational constant that determines the strength of the fourth force of gravity. Now, there's no theoretical reason for it having the value that it does, but if it differed from its actual value by as little as one part in 10 to the 40th of the range of the strength of the fundamental forces that we observe in nature, life itself would be impossible. It might be helpful, actually, to have a sort of visual illustration, if you will, of what that means. So let's be generous. The width of the observable universe is about 30 billion light years. If you were to imagine a tape measure that stretched across the entire width of the visible universe and was denominated in inches, there would be about 10 to the 28th inches in all. Now imagine a pointer setting set on a 1-inch segment of that, and let's peg that as the strength of the gravitational constant. What would be the consequence of shifting that either 1 inch to the right or 1 inch to the left? Well, it would be, given that the 10 to the 28th inches represent the 40 orders of magnitude possible scale of the strength of physical forces, 10 to the 40th divided by 10 to the 28th is 10 to the 12th. So 1 trillion-fold increase or 1 trillion-fold decrease in the strength of the force of gravity, would the be the consequence of a 1-inch shift in comparison to the width of the entire observable universe. That is a sort of fine-tuning that we're seeing present in the gravitational, the strength of the gravitational force. And you can imagine what a trillion-fold increase in gravity would do to the formation of stars and planetary systems, galaxies, or the possibility of life existing. So that's just one example. A second example would be something called the cosmological constant. Einstein's general theory of relativity predicts that the universe is expanding, and this has been observationally confirmed, and extrapolation back in time, both theoretically and observationally, lead to the conclusion that the universe had a beginning in the finite past. It's also been confirmed quite recently that the expansion of the universe is accelerating at a fixed rate, which means that the positive cosmological constant term has to be included in Einstein's equations. And while there's some debate over the nature of this constant, the most plausible explanation of it is that it derives from the vacuum energy of the quantum fields that permeate space-time. And the problem is that the most natural calculation of this vacuum energy leads to a value for the cosmological constant that's about 10 to the 120th times larger than is observed and is compatible with life. So the calculated value would have the universe blowing apart at such an incredible rate that no structures could form at all. And so this means then that the cosmological constant is fine-tuned to 120 orders of magnitude, 120 decimal places. So the third example then, if you think the first two were bad, this is even worse. Consider the fine-tuning of the initial conditions governing how ordered the Big Bang had to be to produce a universe with the structure that ours has. Physicists call this idea entropy. The lower the entropy, the more order a system has. The higher the entropy, the less order it has. So to produce our ordered universe, the Big Bang had to be extraordinarily fine-tuned. It had to be fine-tuned, in fact, to one part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd power, which is to say the entropy of the Big Bang was fine-tuned to 10 to the 123rd decimal places. Now, there are more zeros before the final one in that decimal expansion than there are protons and neutrons in the observable universe. In fact, you'd need, given that there are about 10 to the 80th protons and neutrons in our observable universe, 10 to the 43 universes the size of ours to have as many protons and neutrons as there are zeros in that decimal expansion. So you really need the multiverse to write out the number. Now, that exquisite level of fine-tuning we see in the initial conditions and constants characteristic of our universe, if it were not present, we wouldn't be here.
Now, Bruce, some people oppose the Big Bang model of the universe because they feel that it would not actually produce an ordered universe like what we see. And so, for example, there are actually some folks out there who might, in a certain sense, be considered supportive of an ID viewpoint, but they don't like the Big Bang because they say, well, how can a, you know, intuitively, how does an explosion produce order? But what you're saying is that the Big Bang, although it certainly is, was a hugely tremendous event of energy, it had very, very low entropy. It was a very ordered event. So it's almost like you might call it a very finely tuned explosion, so finely tuned that the fact that it was an explosion still allowed it to produce, you know, the ordered universe that we see. Am I at all within the realm of being correct here?
Sure, Casey. I mean, if you extrapolate backwards from what we presently observe, the galaxies move closer together and closer together, and you eventually have convergence at a point. And this is predicted by the equations of general relativity as well. So there's a strong theoretical and observational basis for asserting that there was a Big Bang in the past. But, you know, these critics are quite right. Explosions are not usually highly ordered events.
Yeah.
This one had to be,
yes,
in order to produce the universe that we have today. So, in fact, it was fine-tuned to one part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd power. That's a hyper-exponential fine-tuning.
Yes, and that is a staggering degree of fine-tuning. But I'll let you continue here about the evidence. But this is very, very compelling what you're talking about.
Well, a universe fine-tuned for life to this degree points strongly, and I think you would agree, to intelligent design. And so, naturally enough, those who are resistant to this conclusion are trying to find other ways to explain it. The dominant way or approach to explaining away fine-tuning that's emerged over the last few years is the so-called string multiverse or string landscape. And it combines the number of solutions of string theory compatible with a positive cosmological constant with the mechanism of eternal inflation to generate an unlimited number of universes that have different laws, different constants of nature, and different initial conditions in order to provide the probabilistic resources necessary to overcome the fine-tuning that we observe. So our existence in a universe with these fine-tuned parameters is then supposedly explained by two things. First, that our universe is one of countlessly many with different initial conditions, laws, and constants. And then secondly, by something called the anthropic principle, namely that we wouldn't be here if our universe wasn't one of those that had properties compatible with life. So this attempt to explain away the fine-tuning has a variety of problems. Beyond the, as you can observe, presumptive and rather desperate philosophical naturalism that motivates it. First, consider the mechanism of eternal inflation. The idea of cosmic inflation was first proposed as a solution to other fine-tuning problems. The uniformity of the cosmic microwave background radiation that permeates the universe is an echo of the Big Bang. And then the flatness, homogeneity, and isotropy of the universe, that its large-scale structure looks pretty much the same independently of your vantage point within the universe or the direction in which you're looking. The inflation hypothesis is that a split second after the Big Bang, the universe underwent a period of exponentially fast expansion that smoothed out its features before inflation shut off, and we settled down to the more sedate expansion rate that we observe today. Now, this idea was extended by postulating that the process might be unending, chaotically turning on and off and spawning new universes forever into the future. And at first it was thought that it might be eternal into the past, too, thus obviating the need for a universal beginning. But it was shown conclusively in 2003 that universes having an average expansion rate that's greater than zero over the course of their history, universes like ours, must have a beginning. So in short, even if the string multiverse existed, it would have an absolute beginning in the finite past. And so you can ask, how do you get a universe or multiverse from absolute nothing? Now, contrary to the inclinations of quantum cosmologists, absolute nothing has no positive properties. So you can't predicate quantum mechanical commutation relations of it or describe it by some sort of gerrymandered universal wave function. Rather, you can expect absolute nothing to be and to do exactly what it is, absolutely nothing. Furthermore, even if you postulate the eternal existence of mathematical relations such as Platonic forms or some such, these abstract forms are causally inert. They cannot act or bring into being concrete things that satisfy their own descriptions. So what you got, it seems to me, worst case scenario, is that the whole enterprise of quantum cosmology is based on a huge metaphysical howler. And in the best case scenario, what you've got is that if the equations describe anything at all, they describe a process that is transcendently caused. And the reason for that is simple. If you're going to get space, time, matter, and energy out of absolutely nothing, you need a cause that's not dependent on any of these things, and a cause that's also, unlike abstract objects, capable of acting. And so what that points to is a transcendent, immaterial, timeless in the sense of being logically and metaphysically prior to the first instant of time, timeless, intelligent cause of immense power. I don't see any other possible explanation, metaphysically speaking and logically speaking.
Now, Bruce, this reminds me of a book by Peter Atkins that I read about a year ago. I don't remember the title right now, but at the very end, he does a parody of a famous religious text that many people will recognize, and he says something like, "In the beginning, there was a void, and the void was empty." And then he says, "And in the void, by chance, there was a fluctuation." And so basically his explanation for, you know, where this chain of multiverses came from, I suppose, was a fluctuation in the void. But his explanation for why it happens is, quote unquote, by chance. So, you know, as you said, why should there be a fluctuation in the void? Why do voids, you know, if they truly are absolutely nothing, there's no reason to expect that it should have a fluctuation that then goes on to produce something.
Sure. I mean, you know, the solution, take two quantum fluctuations and call me in the morning, just doesn't quite cut it. What is the void? I mean, it's suggestive of a pre-existing space-time, but that's not what it is. It's absolutely nothing. Space and time came into existence at a point in the finite past. How did that happen? Well, you know, you give a quantum mechanical description of such a thing, but why should quantum mechanics apply to absolutely nothing? It doesn't have a positive characterization. And the equations themselves are mathematical objects that are causally inert. You require a transcendent acting cause to get anything at all. That's just fundamental common sense.
Mm. Well, I'll let you continue on your explanation of the scientific evidence here.
I think maybe it was we were focused on internal inflation. So let me say a few more things about that idea. First of all, it assumes the existence of inflaton fields that describe the inflationary process. But these fields bear absolutely no relation to any other known fields in physics and have properties that were invented solely for the purpose of making inflation work. So it's really kind of an ad hoc device. Furthermore, when you graph these fields onto general relativity, what you find is that while the measure of the set of models that inflate is infinite, so is the set of models that don't inflate. This was a result that Stephen Hawking and Don Page came up with in 87. So even when you restrict inflation to the class of homogeneous and isotropic cosmologies, you require still further ad hoc assumptions before inflation actually addresses the fine-tuning issues that prompted its invention. Because as Roger Penrose has pointed out, expansion from a generic singularity can become whatever type of irregular universe you please, independent of whether there's an inflationary phase. Also, inflation raises fine-tuning issues of its own. Depending on the inflationary model under consideration, for example, the initial energy of the inflaton field is anywhere from 10 to the 53rd to 10 to the 123rd times the maximum vacuum energy that's consistent with our universe having the properties that it does. So what that means is that the energy decay of the inflaton field also has to be fine-tuned to at least one part in 10 to the 53rd, and possibly as much as one part in 10 to the 123rd. So all you've done, really, is replace one fine-tuning issue with another. But that isn't the worst of it. In the process of doing that, you've made the hyper-exponential fine-tuning problem associated with the universal entropy even worse by increasing the entropy the universe could have had on emerging from the Big Bang. So in so doing, what you've done essentially is turned a hyper-exponentially improbable initial condition into a hyper-exponentially improbable initial condition. I mean, way to go. Now, of course, the suggestion is that the countless number of universes that eternal inflation supposedly spawns then overcomes even the most improbable of initial conditions. But, I mean, this generates another problem of an embarrassing sort associated with the bizarre possibility of what cosmologists have been calling Boltzmann brains after one of the 19th century founders of statistical mechanics. Essentially, a Boltzmann brain is a brain like yours or mine that fluctuates into existence out of the thermal background by quantum mechanical means, pops into existence and is, I mean, there are all sorts of assumptions going on in the background here, including kind of a materialistic theory of mind that a functioning brain could just pop into existence like that.
This is very reminiscent of the science fiction novel Hitchhiker's Guide to a Galaxy with the whale, which for no reason pops into existence and then plummets to its death.
Exactly. In the stratosphere, you got a blue whale popping into existence, plummeting towards Earth, thinking, what is this large object approaching me? I hope it's friendly. Of course, as we all know, it doesn't end well for the whale. Similarly, it doesn't end well for Boltzmann brains, and I think we can see also that it doesn't end well for quantum cosmologists who are dedicated to this way of looking at things.
No, because it sounds like science fiction, but go ahead.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because if, as inflation standardly assumes, the empty space in which our universe began is a thermal system, then free-floating Boltzmann brains spontaneously appear under those conditions with a finite probability. And that's, granted, a highly unlikely event, but under the standard conditions for the generation of bubble universes through eternal inflation, the Boltzmann brain problem becomes very serious. In fact, some calculations lead to these sort of free-floating Boltzmann brains infinitely outnumbering normal brains, in which case it becomes infinitely more probable that we ourselves are free-floating Boltzmann brains rather than persons with a history living in an orderly universe that's 13.7 billion years old. So the significance of this is that it suggests that the multiverse hypothesis is falsified because the persons we take ourselves to be are not typical observers within it. So, but beyond this kind of absurd issue, it's clear that eternal inflation provides probabilistic resources for the explanation of absolutely anything, and as a result spells the end of scientific rationality altogether. So that's eternal inflation for you. What about the string landscape? Well, it inherits all of these problems from eternal inflation, but it generates more of its own. So first of all, I guess we need to ask the question, what is string theory? String theory basically postulates that all the matter and radiation in the universe consists of tiny filaments, either open or closed into loops, vibrating at different frequencies in a 10-dimensional spatial-temporal reality throughout which the extra 6 spatial dimensions are folded into little shapes of Planck scale dimension. That is essentially on the order of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Now, one of the perennial difficulties with string theory has been the essentially infinite number of ways of compactifying these extra 6 spatial dimensions, since each way of doing so constitutes a different string theory. And the idea then is that the shape of the compactifications determines the nature of the laws manifested in the 3 large dimensions, and the size of the compactified dimensions determines the strength of the forces, or the universal constants, like the gravitational constant, and so on and so forth. So explaining why these extra dimensions remain compact as well proved to be very difficult, but it was solved in 2003, and the solution carried with it the bonus of yielding positive values for the cosmological constant, and also of reducing the number of solutions from essentially an infinite number down to around 10 to the 500, which is still huge. But once they had a finite number, certain string theorists decided that they could turn a vice of the theory into a virtue by suggesting that this landscape of 10 to the 500 solutions with different laws and constants could be used as part of an anthropic explanation for the cosmological fine-tuning if it were coupled with eternal inflation. So variability in the string multiverse then explains away the fine-tuning of gravity, the cosmological constants, and a host of other fine-tuned factors. And eternal inflation then wipes out the massive fine-tuning of initial conditions. That's the basic idea. Well, we all know at this point what's wrong with eternal inflation. What, if anything, is wrong with string theory and the string landscape? Well, for one thing, string theory's produced, I don't deny it, some very beautiful and interesting mathematics. Whether it's told us anything useful about the universe itself is debatable. It doesn't make any unique predictions that are testable by current experiments. We need to make an appreciative nod here toward the cleverness of string phenomenologists who found a set of models consistent with the minimal supersymmetric standard model of particle physics. But we still don't know whether any of these can actually model our reality. And there remain an impossibly large number of them. Thirdly, the mathematical consistency of M-theory is an open question. And what is M-theory? Well, M-theory, I mean, it stands for membrane or mystery or mother of all theories or whatever you want to call it. It's an 11-dimensional construct that purportedly accounts for the relationship among the 5 anomaly-free classes of 10-dimensional string theory. So if string theory makes sense, the general consensus, it has to be within this larger mathematical structure that we don't know much about called M-theory that's in the background. And nobody knows whether M-theory avoids assigning infinite values to physical quantities or mathematically self-destructing in some other way. And then finally, since we don't really have a clue what this underlying M theory is, we don't even know whether a complete or coherent framework exists that would justify our calling the web of conjectures and approximations that we have about strings a unified theory of some sort. So let me make clear as well that this isn't just my judgment or the isolated judgment of a few cranks. It's the considered judgment of a healthy portion of the physics community, and it needs to be taken seriously. String theory is by no means a foregone conclusion, even though there's been huge excitement about it and the public is well aware of it. Okay. Now, I won't go into the details, but let me also remark that even if you grant the premise of the landscape and quantum tunneling among different string solutions, there's no way even in principle to determine what proportion of space lands in solutions of each type. So no reason to think that the whole landscape could or would be explored by such means. And then lastly, this is somewhat technical, but there's the issue of low-energy supersymmetry breaking. Michael Dine at Johns Hopkins University has argued that if the string landscape of metastable solutions exists, it leads to an expectation of low-energy supersymmetry breaking, which is just false. And this is generally acknowledged to be a serious problem. So Michael Douglas at Rutgers University has responded that while models of supersymmetry breaking driven by a single parameter may favor the low-scale breaking, models involving more than one independently distributed parameter can lead to an expectation of high-scale breaking. So he's tried to mitigate it in that sense. But nonetheless, the idea of favoring some string solutions over others is not a strong result. And since we don't have the mathematical wherewithal yet to provide a definitive answer to how the supersymmetry breaking scale is distributed in a complete ensemble of phenomenologically viable vacua, that is, those giving us the particles of the minimal supersymmetric standard model, Dine's observations remain solid, and they cast doubt on the tenability of the landscape itself. And then finally, there's the issue of meta-level fine-tuning, which Robin Collins especially and John Polkinghorne and others have dwelt on. A cosmological model that randomly varied the laws of nature in the universe as it described would itself have to be subject to lawful constraints were it not to break down. So in other words, the laws governing this process of variation would have to remain stable for the description to be coherent and be qualified by parameters that could vary only within certain tolerances. So even if it were consistently realizable, this carefully structured variation process giving rise to the multiverse requires a universe-generating mechanism that is itself fine-tuned. And that opens the possibility of embarking on an infinite regress of such construction. So the bottom line is that an infinite regress of material explanations can only find resolution in a self-existent immaterial mind that transcends the material universe and gives it being. And that conclusion is driven home by the realization that even the multiverse must have an absolute beginning in the finite past.
If I can maybe throw out a question here, maybe an analogy, if this is a good analogy, you know, somebody who wins the lottery doesn't necessarily think, oh, it was by design that I won the lottery. For every person that wins the lottery, there are thousands or millions that don't win the lottery, and it's no, you know, a statistical miracle that you that somebody wins the lottery. But when you really get down to it, the lottery itself does not exist in a vacuum. Why is there a lottery? Well, the lottery was an intelligently designed phenomena produced that was, you know, designed to produce a winner. And so in a sense, it was intelligently designed that somebody won the lottery, just maybe not that you in particular are the winner. So the lottery itself has to be explained. Is that what
sure,
I'm
I mean,
saying here?
That's fair, yes. Not only do you have the problem of design with respect to the fine-tuning of the parameters associated with our actual universe, but if you postulate the multiverse in an attempt to explain away the fine-tuning, you bump the issue of the fine-tuning up to the next level of the laws that govern the multiverse itself and the origin of the multiverse itself. So you're not going to get away from the design problem by appealing to multiverse cosmology. You have just reinstantiated it at the next level. Essentially, it's a displacement problem. The information problem and the origin of the information associated with fine-tuning doesn't go away.
Okay.
So you know, what can we say? It seems that the whole edifice of the string landscape combined with eternal inflation is kind of like a house of cards built in midair, waiting for a gust of wind and some good old-fashioned common sense to bring it tumbling down. But as we are well familiar with at the Discovery Institute, a strong commitment to philosophical naturalism produces heavy doses of denial and doxastic inertia. So it may take some time before this is acknowledged, and just how much time I wouldn't presume to wager.
Well, Dr. Gordon, this has been an extremely insightful lecture. I've heard you talk about this before, and I think I'm finally starting to understand some of this, because this is complicated material, but I think that you really can help us to understand exactly what the issues are in cosmic fine-tuning and what the objections are and where they themselves have their own flaws. And I recommend our listeners to maybe play this back a few times and you know, and maybe you'll get to it, get to understand, you know, it better and better each time. So thank you very much for being on the show with us.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
Well, this is Casey Luskin on the ID of the Future podcast. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.